Well, hello everyone. Welcome to today's session from the ICMA coaching program. We're on the topic of promoting trust in a divisive world. This is a hugely important topic. It was identified by the 30 ICMA State Association coaching partners as a critical topic, and they suggested the presenters that we have today. And so we're very thankful for their support and engagement around this, and they're helping to identify important topics like this for your consideration. We also have 10 outreach partners that participate in reaching out and trying to have as inclusive a set of presenters and audiences as possible for these webinars, and we appreciate each and every one of them and their involvement in today's session. So our topics are really, you know, what can you do to promote trust? Trust is the coin of the realm, if you will, in local government. If you don't have trust, it's very hard to get anything else done. And so we're going to be looking in some depth at how local governments have built and rebuilt trust. And that's a continuing process, a very important one. And what are useful approaches and resources that can help you with your efforts in doing that effectively? So I'm delighted that we have an outstanding set of presenters here. We have Frank Benest, who is a former city manager in Colton and Brea and Palo Alto, California, and he'll be sharing examples for you about that. And he's now serving as the ICMA liaison for Next Generation Initiatives. And I'm very proud to say he is a co-founder of the coaching program back 16 years ago. Appreciate his championing this effort for you and for the profession. And he has a doctorate in management, and he is very actively involved in this profession in many ways, teaching and training. Then we have Wanda Page, who's the deputy city manager in Durham, North Carolina, and she has a long background in financial issues as well as operational ones, budget and management services in her organization. She has an MBA and has been very active in her state association. And so we're very pleased that she's going to be sharing an example for you about how they dealt in their organization with a very difficult trust issue, an organizational issue. So you're going to be hearing about trust today from many facets, both about the internal organization, trust with your elected officials, and trust with your public at large. And that brings us to Scott Morelli, who's the city manager in South Portland. He was previously also active in city management in the state of Massachusetts. He's can share with you actually all examples of trust challenges. He's had his hands full there in South Portland. And so he's going to be able to give you a framework of how do you balance and grapple and juggle all these issues and how do you build a framework to go forward effectively. He's a credential manager with ICMA and he's a certified manager with the Maine Town, City, and County Management Association and on their board of directors and has an MBA as well. So we're so thankful that they're here with us today. And I'm Don Maruska. I'm a master certified coach and director of the ICMA coaching program and the producer and moderator for these sessions. And so very grateful that all of you are joining us here today. So one of the things we'd like to do, because we believe that learning is really a group and community effort, is to find out how many of you are there in groups. And while we're grateful for all of you, whether you're there on just on your own or you're there with a large group, we're pleased for everyone's participation. But we found if you can get two or more people and even a larger number together, it really helps to build the momentum for applying what you come up with. And so we really encourage you to do that in order to be effective. And again, if you're looking for the presentation materials, they're in the handout section on the GoToWebinar control panel that you have. And they're also available on the website, and I'll be giving you detailed information about that later. We encourage you to use the question function to communicate with us about questions that you have on this topic that you would like our panel to address, and I'll be hitting those as we go forward in the discussion throughout this hour and a half. So I'll just close up our poll here, see what the results look like. And we can see a lot of you are there on your own, but we have groups of varying sizes, including some of you of over 21 or more. That's outstanding. So glad you've all joined us today. We're going to be looking forward to a good and productive discussion here. And let's turn now to our first presenter, And that's Frank Benest. And Frank, let me give you the controls here. And I'll be here to back up. And we appreciate all the work that you and your colleagues put together for today's session.
Okay. Thank you, Don. As Don mentioned, trust is the key currency for 21st century leaders. All the big issues of the day are, we're going to start with three major takeaways. I got too carried away. There's three major takeaways that I'd like to present. One is make a personal connection with interested parties if you want to engender trust. Number two, engage stakeholders in authentic conversation. We'll be talking about conversations in a few moments. And number three, incorporate the ideas of stakeholders to create a shared solution. Okay, as I mentioned, trust is the key currency for 21st century leaders. All the big issues of today are divisive and emotion-laden. Traffic congestion, affordable housing, immigration. To address these big challenges, local government leaders need trust. Yet we must acknowledge significant trust deficits, what Fisher calls trust deficits, internally in our organizations as well as externally outside our organizations. Even though we face distrust, leaders must still act amidst all the uncertainty. If we're going to improve communities and organizations, we have to act. We can't let distrust immobilize us. Okay, I'm going to forward this. Don, can you forward? Oh, there we go. There's plenty of research to suggest that trust is a critical issue. Let's go back one, Don. Thanks. Inside organizations, only 49% of American employees have a great deal of trust in their bosses. Outside our local government organizations, only 40% trust their local government. So people choose to follow or not to follow based on their relationship and their level of trust. I'm sorry, let's go back one. Don, can you put it back one? So why trust? Everybody has veto power. Any stakeholder group inside the city or the county or the special district or any stakeholder group in the community can block you and block your proposed solution. The big challenges of the day are adaptive, not technical challenges. Filling potholes, for example, is a technical challenge. Addressing the gang problem or the opioid epidemic or homelessness, adaptive challenges. With these adaptive challenges, there are no right or wrong solutions. Value conflicts abound. Every stakeholder group has its own preferred solution. Think of traffic congestion. Everybody has their own preferred approach to dealing with that problem. And adaptive challenges requires more leadership, not more management. Management is based on your formal authority, your positional authority. So management can only force a minimal level of compliance inside the organization and certainly not outside the organization. Leadership is based on your interpersonal attributes. I would suggest that it's about winning the hearts and minds of people. So leadership is based on your ability to build relationships and thus engender trust. Don, can you forward it?
Yes, we're going to go to a polling question. And one of the things we wanted to learn early on is where people are seeing trust issues arise in their organizations and their activities. So I'm going to put up the polling question here. Click off as many of these arenas as you find trust issues coming forward. I'm noticing a couple of questions coming in with regard to the sound. If you're having any sound issues, as highlighted in the reminder email, we recommend that you use the telephone connection, because that typically is a better quality connection than the internet, which is dependent upon the conditions in your local delivery. So we invite you to use the telephone connection if you're having any sound questions. And while this question is up on the table here about where you're encountering trust issues in your organization, we had an interesting conversation before this session about whether trust issues are getting bigger or less or about the same as they've been in the past. And I think the consensus across our polling group is that we have been noticing trust becoming ever larger. And so this is really a topic that's become a critical one. And in many instances, local government is the last bastion, if you will, of opportunity to address trust, because it's a chance to meet with people face to face. I'm also getting a comment, Frank, that the sound's coming through clearly elsewhere, but not as strongly from you. So if you might speak up a little bit more, that'll help out our audience.
Okay. I will do that.
Take a look at how people responded. So can see across the board, it's quite strong, especially with the public, also even within organizations, as well as with elected officials. And we're going to be addressing all three arenas here in today's session. And we're going to be clearly seeing where we can help you make a difference.
So I'm going to present a mini case study related to trust building. This experience happened in 1989 when I was hired as a young city manager in Brea, California, in Southern California. Brea is a middle-class community of 35,000 people, which is becoming increasingly diverse. The first week on the job, the mayor came up to me and said, "Frank, we're glad you're our new city manager, and we have just a small problem." Now, the mayor says we just have a small problem, it's usually a big problem. The mayor said, "We got these quote-unquote illegal aliens," that's the term he used, "who are day workers congregating in the downtown in front of merchants and blocking access to the stores. So I want you to call the police, Mr. City Manager, and use the cops to move these day workers out of the downtown." I just didn't feel that was right or just. So I told the mayor that I needed a little time to check out the problem. So next slide, Don. So we organized a diverse staff team and did some research, and we found there weren't, in the late 1980s, there weren't many program models. Now there are, but there weren't many programs that we could emulate. So finally, I proposed a jobs program at a community center that would be operated by city staff. And that proposal generated intense conflict. People felt that the workers were illegally in the country, which wasn't true. Many were in fact documented and were legal in the country. And particularly they didn't want to spend their tax dollars on illegal aliens. The team felt I had to back off and seek another solution. So I did. It was good advice. So we expanded the team to include day workers and merchants and faith leaders and volunteers. And we started a series of conversations with stakeholders, including, of course, the day workers and the merchants and the police. And we began to address their concerns. So the city council and local community members felt that we shouldn't spend their tax dollars on day workers, and that our solution was just basically too costly. So the community service department proposed a job center on vacant city land off the main drag, and that they would get a donated modular unit to be placed on the vacant lot and a part-time staff person to supervise the job center. The city council and the city attorney did not want city staff making matches between the day workers and the contractors. So the day workers said, "Hey, we'll make our own matches." And then the merchants raised a concern that day workers if they didn't get a job on a particular day, would move back to the downtown and to their stores and block access again. So the day workers proposed a policy that if you didn't get a job one day and you stayed in the center, you would be first in line the next day. And then the faith leaders reached out to the adult school and got a series of classes, including English as a second language classes. So if you didn't get a job, day workers that day could learn English in the ESL class. So we engaged the job worker, the day workers, to run the job center. We showed our work. We were pretty transparent about what we were trying to do. We focused on big why. And for us, the big why provided a solution to work for the day workers and the merchants, and especially a solution that wouldn't tear our community apart. And for us, that was a big why. We finally recommended a pilot job center for day workers, and it was approved on a 3-2 vote by the city council among some controversy. And that pilot turned into a great success and has been a longstanding program in Brea. Next slide, please. So how were we able to engender a fair amount of trust so we could try out the solution? First of all, we expanded the team to include all stakeholders, not just staff. We engaged all stakeholders in authentic conversations, and that allowed us to build relationships. As David White says, leadership is the art of conversation. With whom are you having conversation? What's the content of the conversation? And most importantly, are you truly open to the conversation? We acknowledged the problem and addressed them. Even if we didn't believe it was a problem, if people had a problem, it was therefore a problem. We showed our work, we're transparent. And most importantly, we ensured that everybody got their fingerprint on the solution. So my original solution became everyone's shared solution as it morphed over time. We took some risks. There's no payoff in community life or organizational life without taking some risk. Now, we minimize the risk by calling the job center a pilot, and we also spread the risk by engaging various stakeholders in the proposed solution. And then finally, we went slow to go fast, and that's one of the paradoxes of leadership. You go slow if you want to go fast. Next slide, please. Now, I want to suggest that you avoid seeking buy-in. We all in local government think buy-in, we talk buy-in. We want buy-in from employees, from the governing board, from community groups. However, if we seek buy-in, we will fail. Buy-in is inherently manipulative. We want others to buy our idea that we are selling, for instance, the jobs program at the community center. People can smell buy-in a mile away, and they will resist the idea even if it's a great, great solution. Next slide, please. So instead of trying to get buy-in, I suggest we need to engage stakeholders in authentic conversations so leaders can surface other ideas, identify problems and concerns, and then you can incorporate those ideas and issues into the final solution. So connection and trust are created by entering into, again, what I call these authentic conversations. And therefore, followers may follow if they feel connected to you. Next slide, please. So here are 10 quick tips to generate trust in the messy, uncertain world of local government. Number one, embrace uncertainty and messiness and try to shape the change as it occurs. You can't manage change, but you can try to shape it as it occurs. Number two, connect on a personal level. Share your history, your family story, your interests. Share yourself and ask others to do the same. Again, that allows relationships form over time. Number three, engage stakeholders in authentic conversations. And as you do that, number four, listen first. Seek to understand the other party. Stephen Covey says that this is one of the great habits of effective leaders. Number five, ask questions with a curious mind. For instance, say, tell me more. And that will help engage in conversation. Next slide, please. Number six, focus on the why. Typically, when we have a problem, we run into a staff meeting, and all we talk about is what are we going to do and how are we going to do it. Focus on the why. The why is, so it allows for people to get self-motivated about addressing the problem. For instance, you know, I'm doing this webinar because I'm committed to growing more leaders in local government and enhancing local governments and the communities that we serve. That's the why for me, and therefore I get pretty motivated about that. Number seven, talk straight, be optimistic, even amidst the uncertainty. And get people's fingerprints on the solution. Pilot everything, number nine. Even if it's not a pilot, call it a pilot. And then finally, number 10, take a ready, fire, aim approach. Try something out. Take some action. Now, you have to go slow to go fast, but at some point, you got to take some action, try something out, fix it up as you go along, and particularly learn as you go. You don't learn before you go. You learn as you go. I'd like to end, next slide, please, Don. I'd like to end with this thought and quote. In real conversations, you don't have to be right. That's key to trust building. As Alan Alda, the actor, once said, real listening is a willingness to let the other party change you. And that's what happens, hopefully, in authentic conversation. Next slide. I'd like to quickly share some resources. A really seminal work was done by Stephen Covey, who was the son of his father, the Steve Covey. He wrote The Speed of Trust, has some great trust tips and also an assessment of relationships and where they're trusting and what are some obstacles to trust. Simon Sinek in his TED Talk, How Great Leaders Inspire Trust, Inspire Action, he says you start with the why. So the title of the TED Talk is How Great Leaders Inspire Action. And then several of the Career Compass columns that I write for the coaching program, Trust Me, The Power of Vulnerability, and Leadership is the Art of Conversation. And I'd like to end with one final thought, which is to get trust, you got to give trust. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Frank, for those very helpful ideas. Now, there were 10 tips there, and I've culled five of them with Frank's guidance here that we could have you respond to in a polling question to just see which things you'd like to particularly take some action and attention to in your organization or in your own work personally. So click off as many as make sense to you in that list. And meanwhile, if you've got questions that you'd like to address with Frank here, help us by just typing those in and we'll address them along the way. There were three quite interesting, I would say, radical ideas in your presentation that's bounced out. And one was, don't seek buy-in. You know, I hear that language so often in many organizations, be it local government or other organizations. Let's be sure we have buy-in on this. And elected officials always want to know that there's buy-in. So can you expand on that a little bit more? Because I think people are very interested and intrigued by that concept of not seeking buy-in. What's the difference between what you're presenting and seeking buy-in?
Well, buy-in is where you're really not open to other perspectives or dealing with other issues and problems and concerns. Basically, buy-in, you want the other person or the other group to accept what you want. And even though it could be a pretty good idea, what you want, people will resist it. because they can smell the fact that you're trying to manipulate them. So I suggest, again, through conversation, identifying these concerns, responding to them, getting incorporating as many ideas as you can into the final solution, so it's a shared solution, and that's not buy-in.
Okay, and then on a couple other items, just briefly, your suggestion of piloting everything. I think many organizations, by the time they come up with what they think a good answer is, say, oh goodness, we don't want to ever revisit this. When you say pilot, that suggests that you're going to revisit. How do you balance, you know, keeping forward momentum and from being drawn backwards, and yet pilot everything?
Well, let's take the classic example. Even though I love President Obama and what he did, if you look at Obamacare, it was not piloted. The website was launched countrywide, and it was a disaster initially because they didn't pilot it in a city, in a county, in a small state, a rural area. So you need to, particularly with great complexity, you need to pilot things. And again, the image, the reason I say call it a pilot, even if it's not a pilot, the imagery is that, of course, we're going to make a few missteps. It's an experiment. We're going to see what works, what doesn't work, and we're going to fix it up as we go. And that allows people, it gives you the political acceptance to try something out and move forward.
Okay. Well, and here just very briefly on another topic, people were interested in a little more specifics on how you were able to bring people of different ethnicities and socioeconomic status together. What were a couple key things that you found useful that might be applicable to other jurisdictions?
Well, first of all, in terms of a number of the day workers were not English speakers, and so we had staff and volunteers who were Spanish speakers reaching out to them and engaging them in conversation. The other thing is that we went to where the people were. So that meant our staff and our volunteers, we went out to the street and we engaged in conversation. Of course, we did not have to do that with the ministers because the faith-based community, they're organized. So we went to some ministerial association meetings, and we engaged a few of their leaders and our staff working group. So you have to modify and adjust what you would normally do based upon the needs of the group you're trying to engage. It's not about what you want, it's what they need and what they want. And of course, we walked store to store in the downtown talking to merchants. So don't call a meeting of the merchants, go to the stores and have a conversation one-on-one and create connection and relationship, and then you can move forward. And one other thing, I would never, if you have a controversial or contentious issue, never start with a community meeting or an employee meeting. You're just going to exacerbate the distrust and the conflict. Start with one-to-one relationship building and conversation.
Great. Well, thank you for those very helpful ideas, and I see that they really have resonated with our audience as many useful takeaways. And we'll be coming back to Frank and the rest of our panel at the end for additional questions, and I see some additional ones that have been piling up here, and we'll look forward to getting to as many of those as we can. But for now, we want to move forward and welcome Wanda Page from Durham, North Carolina. Welcome, Wanda. So glad you're with us. And help us understand your experience about building and rebuilding trust within your organization.
Thank you, Don. So I will also begin with a few takeaways, three of them to be exact. Trust building starts before any incident and not during it. Management must always respond quickly. And there needs to be a great deal of thought, review, and analysis around the repair, if trust is lost and repair becomes necessary. Well, I can pretty much assure you that it will make the situation worse. So I look forward to speaking with everyone today on our experience in the city of Durham. So who are we? The city of Durham is the fourth largest city in North Carolina. We have over 270,000 residents. We have an elected mayor and six council members. And we have about 22,650 full-time employees with operating and capital budgets of $477 million, $391 million, respectively. The city, since 2013, has an adopted strategic plan. You see our goals listed there. Certainly, accomplishing initiatives and advancing our organization and our community is not possible without trust. Yes. So what we do at the city is we actually have an employee engagement survey every 2 years. This survey helps us measure employee engagement, and the tool itself includes some very specific questions about trust. What I have focused on here, just for contrast, is if you would see the city management score, we have a score of 39% of our employees who are engaged and in some ways have, you know, extensive trust of us. But on the contrast, 79% of our employees trust their direct supervisor. So in our organization, we are trying to strategize around how to get some of those successes at the one-on-one level, direct supervisor, employee level to transfer up to city management, because it is important as it relates to trust. And so when trust is tested, is going to be my example. Next slide, please. So in the city of Durham, back last year, a little over a year ago, we actually had a very large water line to break in an area of our community. It was a major emergency repair, and it took the team that went out to repair that 8 hours. Very shortly after the repair, our repair employees were noticed actually making the repair because it was so extensive. And after the repair was complete, an environmental scientist in the community notified our department, water department, that the soil where the repair was taking place was known to be contaminated with arsenic and lead. This knowledge had been present, it had been known by some for about 12 years. After the notification and before we were actually in a position to have everything lined up to send these employees in for testing, 25 days passed. That is a long time. And it is one of the main issues that caused us to have this breach of trust by our employees. When those employees were sent to our testing center, the City of Durham's testing center, some of them were confirmed to have higher than expected arsenic levels in their bodies. Now, 25 days had passed. It could have been related to the repair, could have been related to something else. But all of those conditions that happened in the 25 days could, you know, added to this lack of trust. So shortly thereafter, additional staff members that were near the site started to raise safety concerns and distrust of the information that was being shared by the city about the exposure to the site. Next slide, please. Concerned staff, more and more people started to come to management. When management tried to provide responses, they were just not trusted. The responses weren't trusted. So the staff actually contacted multiple local media outlets. So I have added some of the articles that showed up in local newspapers and on TV stations in the area. So this internal trust issue actually generated an external communication issue.
Just before you go to how you responded, Wanda, let me just explore with you a little bit some of the context for this. You were showing the information at the start about the degree to which city management was trusted and engaged the employees versus the supervisors. Was this issue really the flashpoint for that, or was that an ongoing kind of issue that was experienced in the organization? And just to get a sense of to what degree it was driven by this specific issue and how it was handled versus, you know, a broader issue.
Well, it is a broader issue for us because we believe that trust, you know, trust needs to be in place before an issue like this actually happens. We do have significant trust in our organization, but sometimes it's not in management being the department directors and the city leaders. So we are working to improve that. Meanwhile, we did have this issue occur, during the time that we've been measuring trust.
Okay.
Or engagement of our employees.
And the tools that you used to measure trust, did you get any feedback from the providers of those tools to let you know whether those the trust in management versus trust in one's direct supervisor is typical or different from other organizations? Oftentimes, the person that people feel closest to is the one they trust more, so it's kind of typical for trust to be less with folks that they don't interact with on a day-to-day basis. Did you get any insights about that from other organizations and how you compared?
We did. We did get that type of insight from other organizations, but at the same time we got the insight, we got recommendations from the consultant that helped us with our last survey. And some of the, you know, recommendations that we received were around, you know, why is there such a difference? Is it that the hard decisions or sometimes the, changes that we have to make in the organization are blamed up particularly when there are changes that may not be received well by employees, so that employees do trust their own supervisors and blame, you know, upper levels of management for the changes that they don't like. So we are putting some strategies in place to have more of a unified voice across all our levels of supervision to try to engage employees more directly, certainly because trust is important for advancing our organization, as I mentioned earlier, but having trust across the 2,500 plus employees that we have is very important when an incident such as the one I'm speaking about today happens with our organization.
Okay, thanks. That's very helpful context. So what I'm hearing from you is that there's a fundamental issue here and challenge that leadership of an organization has of how do you engender trust when you're not working with people shoulder to shoulder day to day. So let's hear how you responded and what takeaways you have to offer to our audience. Thank you.
Back one.
I can help you with that if you'd like. There you go.
Oh. Okay. Right here. So we actually had a situation that required, you know, pretty much required all hands on deck, you know, at this point. We had to involve our water department, of course, where the incident occurred. We had our city manager's office involved, our risk management department, our subject matter experts, our public affairs department, all helping us manage communication and discussions with employees, with the local media, and just the general public. Specifically, the department, certainly was very focused on the 10 or so employees that had been directly involved that day in the repair, that one repair. So we scheduled tests with those employees, additional tests. I mentioned earlier that the first test we provided was 25 days after the incident, but we continued to provide testing for those employees. We got experts to explain the results, counseled them, the people who were involved as well as their families. We brought them in individually, brought them in with their families, had multiple experts speak to them about arsenic and lead and the exposure and, some of the things to look for, some of the myths that may be in play compared to facts. We also prepared and distributed a fact sheet for all 350 plus employees of the department, even employees, who were not involved, but who were coworkers of these employees who had been involved that day. And that was sort of a consistent, as I mentioned, all hands on deck process. I think I went more than one.
Yes.
Okay. So we performed additional, tests on the site and communicated the results of those tests for reassurance that the risk was actually contained and employees were safe. We even tested water in our water distribution system in the area to assure residents that were drinking water, the city's water, that the water that they were drinking was safe. So as you can tell, this sort of expanded, quite a ways from just a repair in one area. Immediately, we began collecting information from federal and state databases to document possible soil contamination areas to prevent future work site exposure. And this was a very important part of what we did because, as I mentioned, it was knowledge was available that particular site had contamination on it before our workers were even dispatched to go there. But we didn't have that information in a accessible place. And there could have been a different type of response to the water main break if we would have been a little more proactively collecting data in order to ensure that the right crews went out. I think I'm going the wrong direction here.
I'll help you from here. Let me do that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So we even went so far as to the situation became, such high profile. We removed the entire section of that damaged water line in the affected area just from our water system. We responded to news media inquiries regarding concerns that were consistently being raised by our employees and the public. As you can tell, we certainly had some lessons learned in this situation. Number one, trust building starts before the incident, not during it. We need that equity in the bank before a crisis. We do think this whole response to this incident probably lasted about a week and a half to 2 weeks. And we believe if we didn't have a certain amount of trust, which I tried to demonstrate a little earlier, that we work on it all the time, it probably could have blown up into a much bigger situation and lasted a lot longer. But we do acknowledge that management must respond faster. We should have responded faster in this particular situation once it became known that there was a potential problem. And this lack of response caused some of the unnecessary fear and distrust by staff. So just the action of holding or waiting to respond really, really caused us to probably have more of an incident around this situation than we would have had. One thing we also found out is subject matter experts must be credible with staff. One of the things we heard a lot is the initial testing that our employees had, you know, it was our doctors, management's doctors. You know, they are going to say what management wants them to say. And so we really started to add external parties, you know, experts from, you know, federal and state agencies, as well as other medical professionals who were not affiliated with the city of Durham by contract or not our own doctors. And all of this we did very quickly during the time we were reacting to the situation. And it was certainly helpful in our situation. And then proactively we did seek, and we now maintain this database of other contaminated sites to try to prevent a future exposure of this type. Because, you know, we did lose some trust in this incident, as is always the case when something negative happens. You can lose trust, and you have to make sure that you implement, put into practice and into policies ways to prevent that same thing from happening again.
Okay. Well, I know a number of questions have come in about your presentation, and so thank you for sharing, you know, what was obviously a very difficult and challenging circumstance and not, you know, the brightest moment for Durham. So we appreciate you sharing your laundry here with people. That's very generous of you. But some questions have come up, just some clarifying questions. People were wondering, what were some of the factors in waiting for the 25 days or in waiting for the time to notice? You know, sometimes organizations say, well, let us get all our facts together. Let us get our arms around this before we talk about it. But you're encouraging from your example that people really get out there much earlier. What were some of the things that drove early decisions that resulted in some of the challenges that you described?
So I can certainly say that, again, the repair took about 8 hours, and within a very, very short period of time after that repair was done, the notice came to us that that site had contamination. It was a report. So during the time of the 25 days, different people were reviewing the report to determine whether or not, even if there had been contamination left there after a cleanup, was it contamination that would have been enough to be harmful to employees working there? And the majority of that time was spent in the department. It did not raise above the department management in terms of to the city manager or others who would be decision makers, but it was within that department trying to determine whether or not, you know, the employees that had worked there had been exposed. I think one of the reasons it is that it had already happened. It couldn't be prevented. It had already happened. And they were trying to make sure that there was a need to do something. Ultimately, that decision was removed. It got taken out of their hands because of the employees themselves finding out about the report that had been sent to the city and demanding some action for themselves. And so that's what was going on during the 25 days.
And again, we're getting comments here that people are very thankful for the straightforwardness with which you're sharing your story and how much people in our audience are learning from the candor of your story. One of the things that people were asking about is, you know, sometimes these issues like this open the city up to liability. And how do you promote trust over an issue where the city has potentially significant legal or other exposures? You know, that's a challenge, I think, in these sorts of circumstances. How did you grapple with that in your situation?
Well, one of the things that we did is while we were working on the communication and working on all the testing, we never actually removed the case, if you will, from what would be our normal process for any type of employee potential harm to an employee in the line of duty. So we have a risk management division of our organization, and that risk management division would be following a case of, you know, any employee that has been injured in an accident or anything else that has occurred to them on the job. And we were and are treating this particular incident the same way. So it would be in the hands of our legal team and our risk management team, handled no differently. Because it became, you know, public and in the media, it still is handled no differently than we would handle any other case where an employee was injured or potentially injured, you know, in the line of duty.
Okay. And you described the importance of having subject matter experts that are credible with the staff. And so a question came up from our audience here about, well, how do you go about finding such people and making sure they're not biased in another direction? And what parameters did you use to, hire such people?
So we have a contracted practice that deals with our workers' compensation claims or any type of workplace injury situations, and that is the practice we initially set the employees to have their tests done. And once we realized that our employees were not trusting the results that came back from those doctors because they were our doctors, and it did indicate that there some, not even all of them, but some of the employees that had been on the site that day had higher than normal readings of the contaminant. We had all of the employees or any other employee, whether they had been mowing, you know, a quarter mile away or a half mile away, if they felt they had come close enough to that site, we actually hired a totally different doctor that we did not have any, that had no relationship with the city, and had that doctor do testing of all of these employees, and had that practice provide the results to the employees, independent of anybody on our staff, or anybody that was part of our contracting arrangements before. Okay. And I will say that did satisfy the employees. So we were able to get satisfaction, get those employees satisfied by selecting another practice and not pushing back on that.
Okay, thank you. So let's go to a polling question here, because what we're interested in is how these lessons learned, tough lessons, hard-earned lessons that Durham's candidly sharing with you, which we appreciate, what resonates for you. So we invite you to click off as many of these four items as are relevant to you and what you'd like to take away from this situation. What we're trying to do with these examples is really dive into very specific illustrations, because we think in the specifics of an example, the broader lessons come out. And so while you may not be dealing with arsenic poisoning or other sorts of issues in your community, we're really looking at this as a case study in how to address and respond to these kinds of topics. And so that's really the purpose of what we're going after here. One of the things that we're going to get to a little bit later is, after we hear from Scott Morelli, is what are some of the measures and ways in which local governments are trying to assess the level of trust that they have, that their community has with them. So we'll be coming to that a little bit later and thinking about what are some ways and resources around that topic. And we also invite our audience, if you've got experiences with that, to send it in via the question function, and we'll highlight those as well. But let's take a look here at what resonated for our audience about what you shared. We see that many of the messages did in the very big ways, especially building trust beforehand, getting that equity bank in place, and responding quickly were two that they especially highlighted. So we really thank you, Wanda, for your presentation around that topic. And we're going to be coming back to you and the rest of our panel after we hear from Scott Morelli. So Scott, please join us in, and we'll move on to your section of the presentation here. Thank you, Scott.
Hey, thank you, Don. So my section of this session, we're going to get into a few specific examples here of things that we've experienced in South Portland during my time as city manager, which has been for about the past 2.5 years. So the three kind of key takeaways, even though I have a few more than this for folks, the three kind of key points that I want to make is be sure to learn from your past, both the good, the bad, and the ugly. Kind of that old phrase, those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. So I think that's an important point. Being transparent is another one. I think you probably hear this all the time. Of course, we want to be transparent in local government, but you know, even going beyond that, the kind of no comment is no good. That phrase doesn't inspire a lot of trust when people hear it. And then also ethics certainly matter. Making sure we're doing the right thing is paramount to helping to maintain or regain public trust. And so if you're doing something, that's not ethical, whether it's you or your staff, they're kind of like those self-inflicted wounds. You give yourself a black eye, and we certainly, we want to avoid that from happening. So a little bit about South Portland, and I'm tying in some relevant information here that are going to be key to some of the examples that I give to you. We're the fourth largest state in Maine. During World War II, we had a local shipyard that built 236 Liberty ships for the war effort, and it employed over 30,000 people during its peak. We also had, around the same time, a pipeline that was built from our port to Montreal to help ensure the safe delivery and transport of oil to Canada. We also have the largest railroad yard in New England, and we have a population that is very highly educated and engaged, 43% with a bachelor's degree or better, compared to 30% in the U.S. and 29% in Maine. We've had over the past, not even 10 years, really half decade, a number of divisive issues that have led to unusually heated public arguments, acrimony at council meetings, and just a lot of distrust of both elected officials and staff. And we are still certainly in the process of healing from some of these things. We're not there yet, but we're working on it. One of the biggest things going back about 6 years or really about 10 is our tar sands ordinance. And about 10 years ago, our code officer and planning board approved a request by the pipeline company that I had mentioned earlier to reverse the flow and to begin bringing tar sands in from Canada and other locations in the U.S. to our port. And they never ended up going forward with it, so the permit expired. But once they started the process again, many residents caught on to it and were very upset with the city for even having previously approved such a permit because they felt that the ordinance already prohibited it. So why on earth would staff allow this to go forward? When that didn't gain traction, a group of citizens in 2013 formed a committee to create an ordinance that banned tar sands from coming to our numerous coastal terminals. And we had a lot of contentious debate in our community on this issue. You'll see here a photo from one of the sessions at our community center. About 500 people there. You'll see the folks in blue shirts were for the ordinance, and folks in the red shirts were against it. And the issue came to referendum in November 2013. The part that made this a little tricky, however, was there were a lot of people that actually supported the intent of the ordinance, but felt it was overly broad and would impact other waterfront activities. And so there were people, including members of the city council, who urged folks to vote down the proposed ordinance and promised that the city council would then take up a new, more narrow ordinance that would address the issue. And so the question did fail at referendum, and the city council, as had been promised, did go forward and approve a more narrow scoped ordinance. This led predictably to a lawsuit. The city has spent $2.5 million of its own money to date to defend it. We won our first round in federal court, and we're currently in appeals court in Boston and are awaiting the decision there. But the big kind of controversy, in addition to this being a significant issue that has the potential to wind up in the Supreme Court, but it really, there's still a lot of acrimony from certain sectors of the public who believe that the council defied the will of the voters by enacting an ordinance after voters had rejected it. And so I wonder, I wasn't here at the time, but I wonder, was it really explained all that well to people that supported the intent of the ordinance but did not actually vote for it because the initial ordinance was too broad? Could that have been explained better? And I think certainly supporters will say, yes, we clearly explained it. People knew why we were voting against it and that we were just going to go and enact something a little bit different afterwards. But there is still certainly a sentiment out there by many opponents that feel like that wasn't the case and that this was an example of the city just doesn't listen to its residents. There was another controversy that happened right on the heels of this issue when a proposed liquid petroleum gas project was slated for the rail yard that I had mentioned earlier. And again, our code officer endorsed the plan as compliant with city ordinance in front of the planning board. This greatly upset neighbors to the project. They had great fears about safety. And we had residents, including one in particular, very vocal, who questioned the code officer's interpretation of the ordinance. And he gained enough traction with his argument that it, in fact, wasn't compliant with our ordinance that the city ended up hiring a consultant to actually review whether or not, in fact, it was compliant with our ordinance. And I think, in hindsight, that was a very good move because it was either going to support what was already decided. And so you've got this third party, independent, in theory, person coming in to give an unbiased perspective. But it also could have gone the other way, and it could have shown that the city was, in fact, not the code officer hadn't made the right interpretation. And in that case, it would have prevented us from going down a path that would most certainly have led to some legal issues. And so the consultant took a look, and in fact, that's what they found. They found the code officer had, in their opinion, misinterpreted the code. They said the storage facility was not allowed. And so we reversed course. The company pulled the proposal. And so ultimately, we ended up getting right. But we had a city councilor at the time, as shown in the article that I've got up here on the screen, just lambasted staff in public, saying we had wasted time and money to get things right. And if not for this one resident pushing the issue, we could have wound up in a very bad place. And again, I was not here. I came in just shortly after this issue. But I wonder, did our code officer at the time check with legal counsel to make sure that they also agreed with their interpretation? Because this is a pretty controversial project. And so I always believe in checking as much as possible within reason with legal counsel ahead of time. The whole ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure theory, and I'd rather spend money on legal bills up front than on kind of lawsuits at the end of it. So after these issues, our code officer decided to retire after 35 years with the city. Our city manager, who had been here for 9 years in that position and 30 overall with the city and did a fantastic job, he decided that he'd rather be county manager and moved across the bridge. So that's around the time that I came in, and on the heels of these major issues that had already kind of strained trust, both trust for the, with the council from the public and also trust of staff with both the public and some city councilors. Several other issues have popped up over the past years that also had the real possibility of really further eroding people's trust in what we're doing. And so we knew we had to handle these things the right way in order to avoid further damage. So the first one happened almost exactly a year ago, our $1 million mistake. We had just purchased a $1.1 million ladder truck. And 2 days after we had put it in service, we had some firefighters training and testing on it, and they accidentally struck some overhead power lines, and we were extremely fortunate that none of our employees were injured. But as you can see here in the picture, the ladder truck wasn't as fortunate. And this screenshot is from a segment on the nightly news, one of several that appeared that evening. And this picture had made its way earlier in the day and subsequently made the rounds on social media with the predictable comments about government worker incompetence and wasting tax dollars. So we knew we had a real big issue on our hands here. And so we immediately had our safety officer begin conducting an investigation. We needed to know what happened and to make sure that this never happened again, because we were fortunate this time no one was injured. And that we were just dealing with the potential loss of a new vehicle, but God forbid something like this happen again, and we end up dealing with injury or loss of life. We interviewed a witness who said we interviewed a witness who said they saw the event happen. We wanted to make sure we had their perspective, because there were also some comments out there on social media that another person had seen what happened, and they claimed that it was done intentionally, as crazy as that sounds. So we wanted to kind of snuff out and put an end to that type of discussion. But we made sure we kept the media well informed throughout the process, of course, giving city councilors an advance copy of anything we sent out. But, we sent out frequent press releases even while we were conducting the investigation, because we knew it was going to take a decent amount of time in order to conduct an investigation. But we didn't want the public kind of making up their own mind while this was happening as to what happened. We were very fortunate, even though we figured this was going to happen, that our insurance covered most of the cost of a new ladder truck. And in fact, just earlier this month, we got the replacement truck in. And so that kind of squashed a lot of the public comment about, geez, are we going to need to spend another $1.1 million? We did discipline the employee. We weren't proactive about mentioning that. Obviously, as probably is the case in many other states, we're limited in what we actually can tell the public. But we were sure that the public did know that this employee was also tasked with helping to create new protocols to avoid this from happening again, so that they could have faith that when we get the new ladder truck, this is not going to happen again. And so the eventual result, even though there was a big to-do about it at first, there was really not much backlash from the public once we announced all of these things. And so even though this was a difficult subject, we counted that as a win in terms of we handled it, we think, the best that we could have. Shortly after this issue kind of was dealt with, we had a resident send a video to city councilors and local media outlets purportedly showing a member of the fire department salting his driveway in a neighboring community with a city truck and city salt. And the person claimed this wasn't the first time the incident occurred, but they were getting fed up with it and wanted to really show people what was happening and why is the city letting this happen? Why does the city not know about this? And what are you going to do about it? So we, of course, as soon as we heard about it, we interviewed the employee, confirmed that it did happen, and issued discipline. And because this had been sent directly to the media, they were, of course, on top of this and kept asking, you know, what's happening? What's going, what are we going to do? And we really pushed the envelope on what we kind of could say and release to the media, because we wanted the public really to know that we took this seriously. This wasn't the norm for our employees, and that we were dealing with this. And so I think the lawyers would always have you say, no comment, this is a personnel matter. And in general, I agree with that somewhat, but there is information that you can release. And so we pushed our attorneys a little bit, and we were allowed to make some comments to the public, really saying that we strongly disapproved of what happened, and that we were going to deal with it, and so including having ethics trainings for all of our employees. And so again, what this settled down, there wasn't much backlash after we kind of made that announcement and these articles appeared. I even had a resident call me to thank me for dealing with this, because they felt it was just going to get swept under the rug, and we didn't do that. Another kind of last incident here that I want to share with you, right on the heels of that issue, we had a complaint about racial profiling and discrimination in one of our departments. And this also was tied up in a couple of things that had happened in the state of Maine at that time, one of which gained national attention. We had an issue where, as you see from the headline at the top here, a pro-white town manager ended up being fired after he was promoting some pretty racist stuff on social media, and that gained a lot of national traction. And then we also had some allegations made by a teacher at Kennebunk High School, which is somewhat close to where we are here in South Portland, in Kennebunk, Maine. And so there was already this kind of charged atmosphere of these racial incidents happening in municipalities. And so we knew especially that we had to really be on top of this and deal with this in a quick but appropriate manner. And so the complaint was made by parents about one of their children and the child's treatment in one of our before and after school programs. Our staff vehemently denied anything like what was alleged having taken place. So the parent, after not getting satisfaction from city staff, went to a city councilor, who was very rightfully sympathetic to these types of allegations, as are we. The complaint wasn't widespread. This is something that was just sent to elected to this councilor and involved just the staff in that department. So it wasn't one of those things where the media was jumping on this. But the first thing I did was I recognized that, again, sometimes it takes a third party. We already talked to staff and they denied it, and we felt if we just came out with saying, no, there's nothing to see here, that wasn't going to be believed by this person and could lead to a big media event. And so we hired an outside attorney who specialized in these types of claims. You'll see her profile here on the screen. She did interviews with the parents, did interviews with our staff, and eventually issued a report vindicating us of any discrimination or any sort of wrongdoing. And we kept the parent involved, obviously. They were interviewed, but we kept them informed throughout the process. We shared the results with them, which they were happy with, but they were disappointed that we couldn't share the final report for them. And that goes back to what we can and cannot share under law. Much as I would have liked to have shared it with them, because it kind of proved our innocence in this matter, we still just couldn't share that with them. Again, this could have, if handled incorrectly, been blown up into a much larger issue had we not taken it seriously. We did also keep the city council informed, just because we didn't know if at any point it would become a media issue. We do obviously take these types of concerns seriously, and so we have done a lot of staff training even before this happened around, implicit biases and things like that for our staff, and we will continue to do that as well. So in August of this year, I piggybacked on Martha Perrigo from ICMA attending our state association's annual conference and giving a presentation on ethics. And I had her come do a mandatory training for all of our employees here in South Portland. I really felt that even though I think most of our employees are doing the right thing, it doesn't hurt to make sure that you train them on ethical behavior. And so we did that training in a couple of sessions during one day, and we do have more trainings to come on this topic. And it led to some good discussion. One of the examples that we heard was we talked about acceptance of gifts, and apparently maybe 10, 15 years ago at a conference that the city paid for one of our department heads to attend, they won a truck. And would the public approve if they know about that this person won a truck at a conference and took it home? And did our policy address this kind of a thing? So one of the things that I would really recommend to you and your organization, if it, even though these are somewhat common, is make sure you do have an ethics policy as part of your personnel policy. You should definitely address off-duty conduct, acceptance of gifts, political activities, supporting candidates for any sort of office, and especially prohibiting that on city time, using city resources or misusing city resources, the case may be, and conflicts of interest. And it's really important to instill this in employees from day one. And finally, just some of the lessons that I've learned from these things and wanted to share with you is certainly be transparent. I think more information, not less, is key to building public trust, and trying to avoid that appearance that decisions are just made in those behind the scenes, cigar smoke-filled rooms. Dealing with issues immediately is very important. Others have said this too. The longer an incident goes unanswered, the more that public speculation and misinformation will be spread, and then it's hard to kind of get the toothpaste back in the bottle once that happens. Again, you can only deal with things one step at a time. So we've got a lot of issues here that, as I've noted, that, and I haven't even mentioned all of them, frankly, but there's a lot of mistrust here, and we can only deal with that one issue at a time by doing the right thing and hopefully slowly building back that trust. We also need to make sure that as public servants, we're not afraid to admit mistakes. So as the example I showed you when the third party consultant said that we actually had not done what the ordinance, they thought the ordinance said, could be done, that we reversed course there. And then finally, new eyes, whether it's that third party consultant or you coming into an organization as a new manager, you have an opportunity to identify and correct things that may have just been the norm previously and part of that whole we've always done it that way mentality. So new eyes can definitely help with these situations as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Scott, for, again, a very candid and extensive array of examples here. Really appreciate that thoughtfulness and what you put forward. Let's, while these are fresh in everyone's mind, take a look at what lessons learned from this list to resonate for you and our audience. So click off as many as are relevant to you. Sounded like there might be yet another one that you would add potentially to that list, which is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, huh? In terms of getting out in front of these issues and maybe investing in some experts or whatever, even before the issues become larger, just because it's a very challenging situation to try to turn something around later.
For sure. Absolutely.
One of the questions while we're giving people a chance to respond to this polling question that's coming up is, did these series of issues that arose prompt you to wonder about the sort of overall culture of the organization? And did you have any ways formally or informally to make an assessment of, what were these challenging trust circumstances? You indicated how you addressed each of them as they arose, which was very good. But were they causing you concern about the culture and how to assess where you were culturally on the trust and ethical issues?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, I wasn't here for a couple of the first larger issues. And to some extent, those were also driven by decisions that were out of our control, what the elected officials in one case wanted to pursue. But I think there was definitely enough of that where there's smoke, there's fire, kind of concern that really, again, I think we have great employees, and I think most of them are doing the right thing every day and working really hard. But there was enough concern there, which is why I wanted to bring in Martha to have that ethics training and to make sure that that our longtime employees got that training, but that also now that we're implementing a new employee orientation program here coming right up, that a big part of that or a significant part is going to be dedicated to ethics and reviewing things about accepting gifts and not abusing city resources and things of that nature, so that we regain and keep that public trust, and that just becomes part of our culture.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And as we can see from the polling results here, that people really resonated with not being afraid to admit mistakes and to deal with issues immediately and being transparent. I'm wondering if in that regard, you encountered any comments from your elected officials or from others about, you know, the exposure that you might be creating for your organization and admitting mistakes or being transparent before maybe you had everything figured out is an issue that also came up as Wanda was sharing her story. Did you have some comments or thoughts about that and how you navigated that trade-off and landed where you did?
I mean, you involve legal in just about everything you do when you're dealing with these, especially if it's a personnel matter, because you also want to respect the rights of your employees, even if they have been found to have done something wrong. And so it is a balance between that and information you want to provide the public. There's going to be a lot of times when people want to know everything that happened, and that's just not possible, at least under Maine law. And for a variety of good reasons often. So, but anytime we did go public with any sort of release or information, it was vetted through legal, and we were also careful to consider, is what we're going to release going to cause more speculation? And so you do want to be mindful of that, because you don't want to jump to any sort of conclusions before you have all the facts. But again, at the same time, if you're going to conduct an investigation, and they can take some time between interviewing all the witnesses, checking relevant, city ordinances and statutes and city policies, and then coming up with a final report and recommendations. That can take some time. And if you go radio silent between when an incident happens and when that is released, I think that definitely can lead to a lot of suspicion and what's going on. So even if it's a simple, hey, yeah, we're working with our insurance company and we think they're going to, send out an adjuster next week and we should have an answer about whether or not they're going to cover the truck, and we're still doing an investigation with our employees. Something as simple as that, it gives the reporter something to write about or a snippet for the nightly news cast, but it doesn't really give away any sort of state secrets. But it can help to let the public know you're still dealing with it and view it seriously.
Okay, great. Well, we have four meaty questions here that our audience is challenging us with, and I want to take about a minute on each of them here before we close to cover them. We've got a few other things to do as well here. But one of them is trust is a two-way street. So this goes to you, Frank. How do you maintain a faith and trust when members of the community, organization, and elected officials keep violating your trust? How do you get other people to be trustful when you are, but they aren't?
Well, you have to establish how far you can go and trust people based on your experience with them. There are certain people that are not trustful. However, in saying that, I think there is the leadership responsibility to be optimistic, to be steady, to continue to make small steps forward with other people. So, yes, you recognize those situations where people are untrustworthy, and you still have to move forward with people. And your attitude, you have to model certain kinds of attitude
again, being optimistic and steady, and move forward. Plus, small steps. You got to take small steps with people and give them a All chance right. to move back one level.
Thank you. This one is for you, Wanda, to kick off with, but I invite all the other presenters to offer their response as well. And that is, any experience that you've had in trying to measure trust from the community with your organization? I didn't see any response yet from our audience about anything that they've been doing. So I want to turn to the three of you to see if you're familiar with any ways that organizations can get helpful feedback about the level of trust from their communities. Wanda?
Certainly. You will recall that I provided some detail in my presentation about how we survey our employees every 2 years. We do actually have a statistically based community survey, resident survey that we do, and we weave in the same type of questions there. Do you trust city government to make the best decisions for your family? Those kinds of questions are included, and we get direct responses. We can take those responses as well as anecdotal free comments and evaluate them and evaluate ourselves to determine if we can make steps toward having our residents trust us more to deliver the best service to them, at the least cost.
John, I mentioned that ICMA, I believe, has a partnership with the Center for National Community Survey. So it's very affordable. And typically when they do these surveys, they try to gauge trust outside in the community.
Okay, great. Thanks. And Wanda, just to go back to you for a second on this one, do you recall the organization that does this work for you in case people would want to know about how to get some more information?
Yes, it is ETC. I can provide additional contact information for that,
okay.
for that organization.
Sounds great. And let's move on to another topic here. And while we're doing that, I want to go to a couple of resources here. You heard Frank refer to the Career Compass columns. There's lots of other resources for you. And while we're addressing this next question that's come in and finishing up with some others, I would like to ask our audience to give some feedback to us about what areas of value you and your agency got from today's session. So click off as many of the areas in which you found value from today's session, or you think your agency can benefit from the value of it, of this session. We're also going to be making a digital recording available. So if you think that there are things here that you'd like to share with your organization, we will be providing you with a follow-up email with all the information about how to get connected and to do that effectively. But this question is coming around to something that you were raising, Frank. Could you give a few quick tips about having authentic conversations? People were really fascinated by that, and they were wondering, could you give, one, two, or three, quick things that you think help make conversations authentic?
Well, first of all, you got to listen twice as much as you talk, which is very difficult for us. Number two, again, enter into these conversations with a curious mind and ask to get, tell me more because I'm interested in this. And then number three, show the person how you've responded to what you heard. And typically you want to do that within 2 to 7 days. If you respond immediately, people don't think that you really seriously considered it. If you respond after 7 days, people consider that blowing them off. So the sweet spot is responding to the conversation and letting people know how it influenced you within 2 to 7 days.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So let's take a quick look here at the results of this question. See that people really resonated with learning from the examples and really thank our audience. And I've seen many comments come in for their appreciation for your candor and for the details of your examples because they learned a lot from it. And understanding through that what are some of the keys to promoting trust in local government. So thank you very much, panel, for your great job in doing this. We do want to highlight that we've got upcoming, you have some contact information here that'll be available in the post-webinar packet if you'd like to explore some things further. We do encourage you to participate in the brief post-webinar survey. We appreciate feedback. It's the, as they say, it's the breakfast of champions, and we want to be ever improving the ICMA coaching program. We do have an upcoming webinar, which is going to take on to another. Many people are interested in this issue of conversations. Well, how do you have those very, not only authentic, but very difficult conversations with employees, with elected officials, and with your community? And we have an outstanding panel for that coming up. And so just before we close, I'd like to turn in order to our presenters here with a word or quick phrase for our audience before we sign off. Frank Bennis, what would be your word or phrase?
Well, again, I just like to reiterate, you got to give trust to get trust, and you need to take the lead in doing that.
Thank you. Wanda Page.
Yes, mine is not original. It was a statement I read from Warren Buffett. But trust is like the air we breathe. When it is present, nobody really notices. When it is absent, everybody notices.
Thank you. Scott Morelli.
I can't beat those two right there. Those are great suggestions. But I would just go back to what I've kind of said before, you know, the whole ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If you can get in front of things and train your employees on things as well, you can prevent some larger problems from happening. On the other side.
Okay, super. Well, thank you very much. I just want to highlight here on this final slide, it is Thursday, November 14th, when we have our last webinar of the year. Encourage you to put that on your calendars and to register for that. And this is Don Maruska. My closing word is thankful. I'm thankful for our outstanding presenters today and for the attention that you as an audience have given to this very critical issue of trust, and wish you all the best in both building and rebuilding trust, a continual process that's critically important to local government success. Thank you so much. Look forward to you taking advantage of the many resources that are available through the ICMA coaching program. Visit us online and see what's there for you to help you succeed in your career. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.